capturing folks' imagination or interest. So I think it's going to be very close, and I don't know that there's huge enthusiasm, I would say, in the community right now.
And Marisa Franco, would you say that the corporate media is accurate in saying that there is a rightward shift within segments of the Latinx community? We have 30 seconds.
No, absolutely not. I think what Latinos are doing is declaring their political independence from partisan politics. I think the Latinos are looking to see who is going to deliver. I think even if Harris's message is resonating, even if they reject Trump's values and the way he acts, which many do, they fundamentally don't believe that the Democrats will deliver. And that is something that's at the doorstep of the Democratic Party and them deciding, are they truly the class of working people in this country, or are they the class of the sort of upper middle, like corporate sections, like liberal but still corporate. And I think that's what Latinos are questioning. I don't think that they're going to the right. They're looking to see who actually
cares
about
Franco,
them and is going to actually deliver.
I want to thank you for being with us ahead of Magente. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, unions approved the OHSU Legacy Health merger.
Portland mayoral candidate Keith Wilson's dog days are not over.
And Google tries out nuclear power.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 16th, 2024. I'm Zachary Jones-Naray.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. A coalition of unions have come out in support of the recent Oregon Health and Science University merger with Legacy Health, the largest healthcare merger in Oregon history. OHSU leaders started discussing buying Legacy Health in December of 2022. Legacy has struggled financially over the years and has not recovered from the exacerbated costs and patient needs from the COVID-19 pandemic. It has already taken significant steps like requiring employees to take time off, and submitting a plan to end birth services in Gresham, though that was rejected by the Oregon Health Authority. OHSU is not the financially stable suitor it appears to be, given it is the one buying out its rival. In May, OHSU divulged that it lost $44 million in the last 9 months and was considering strategies like restructuring and layoffs to cut costs. The health system also suffered from pandemic-related financial weaknesses, like higher wages for interim staff, lower patient turnover rates, and decreased revenue from complex cases. The merger comes as a financial salve to both institutions, following a corporate buyout and consolidation model to cut costs and expand on loans. The merger would make OHSU the largest employer in the state. As of last September, a document shared to OHSU leaders stated the merger would not immediately solve the health system's problems. Quote, initially, the new integrated system is likely to incur short-term operational losses through 2028. Most of these losses are driven by factors independent of the integration proposal, would accrue to our individual healthcare systems without a combination, and are similar to those impacting our peer institutions nationally, end quote. Oregon Nurses Association initially leaned skeptical, noting that these types of mergers often end in layoffs and lower quality of care. But a recent agreement signed by OHSU President Danny Jacobs and five unions changed their opinion. Among the Oregon Nurses Association, the other four unions include the Pacific Northwest Hospital Medicine Association, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 75, the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, and the Service Employees International Union Local 49. The agreement ensured that workers in those unions are protected for a year if the merger goes through. The union said in a statement, quote, by prioritizing job security, professional development, and an inclusive workspace, this acquisition is poised to make OHSU the premier healthcare provider and employer in the region, end quote. But non-union members could face layoffs without those protections. The Healthcare Market Oversight Program, the unit of the Oregon Health Authority that reviews the legality and ethics of healthcare mergers, said the OHSU Legacy Health merger could be finalized by early 2025.
Portland mayoral candidate Keith Wilson was bit by a dog while campaigning this past Saturday. He was canvassing around Southeast Mill Street with Mark Johnston, who previously served as President Barack Obama's assistant secretary to reduce homelessness. They heard dogs barking at the home they had just knocked on when four dogs approached the door. The owner was able to control three of the dogs, but one of them launched at Wilson, biting his arm just above the elbow. Wilson received 10 stitches at Portland Adventist Medical Center. Wilson did not waste the opportunity to keep canvassing when he handed the nurse a campaign card instead of an ID. He has maintained good spirits and a slurry of puns regarding the incident, stating on social media, quote, it's been a tough day, but I'm doggedly determined to get back to meeting more incredible people in every corner of our city, end quote. Wilson continued canvassing Sunday and joked to the Oregonian, quote, they always told me politics was a blood sport, but this kind of takes it to another level, end quote.
Google is going nuclear, literally. The company announced an agreement with Kairos Power to purchase nuclear energy from multiple small modular reactors, SMRs. Kairos's first SMR could come online in 2030, with four other reactors planned to be ready by 2035. No working SMR has yet been constructed in the U.S., nor has Kairos created a working demonstration of its technology. The only countries with operating SMRs are China and Russia. Google, like other large tech companies, needs the electricity to power AI and cloud storage. Google's Senior Director of Energy and Climate, Michael Terrell, said in a press statement, quote, this agreement helps accelerate a new technology to meet energy needs cleanly and reliably and unlock the full potential of AI for everyone, end quote. Last month, Microsoft revealed the possibility of reopening the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania to fulfill some of its power needs. In July, President Biden signed a bipartisan ADVANCE Act aimed at jumpstarting new nuclear power technology.
Oil and gas companies walked away from their wells in the 1990s when crude prices plummeted, but they still emit pollution. The Well Foundation and a Montana former oil and gas executive are capping them. With those detail and more, Mark Morin reports.
When crude oil prices fell in the 1990s, companies left at least 3.2 million oil and gas wells abandoned and unplugged around the United States. One man in Montana is capping some of those wells, trying to shape American climate policy. Curtis Shuck was checking on some crops in northern Montana in 2019 when he noticed a rotten egg smell, something he knew he shouldn't be smelling. A nearby abandoned oil well was emitting methane.
Really by accident, honestly. I mean, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time, depending on how you look at it. And just couldn't believe what I saw. And so that left such an impression on me that, you know, throughout the rest of that day.
Shuck vowed to look for funding and cap as many abandoned wells as he could. He decided to create the WellDoneFoundation.org from his pickup truck, even before he made it back to Bozeman that afternoon. So far, their former oil and gas executive has capped 45 wells in 14 states. The Environmental Protection Agency reports the number of abandoned wells has remained largely unchanged. It estimates they emit at least 300 kilotons of methane and more than 8 million metric tons of CO2 every year. More than half remain unplugged because, Shuck says, regulators don't know who they belong to. That lack of accountability has led to blame shifting and toxic wells left uncapped.
Literally, it was, you know, everybody's dirty little secret. The oil companies didn't want to talk about it. The regulators certainly didn't want to talk about it. The industry associations wanted nothing to do with it. And so everybody pointing their finger at everyone else.
Shuck says the most polluting well his group has capped was emitting more than 10,000 grams of methane per hour. The EPA says there's strong evidence that reducing methane emissions can significantly slow climate warming. This story was produced with original reporting from Michaela Haas for Reasons to be Cheerful. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
Former President Trump again stops short of ensuring a peaceful transfer of power. A Georgia judge rules election administrators must certify vote results, and Vice President Harris looks to strengthen support from Black male voters. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I left the morning that I was supposed to leave. I went to Florida. And you had a very peaceful transfer.
At a Chicago Economic Forum, former President Donald Trump again refused to clearly rule out violence if he loses next month. Trump continued to downplay the January 6th Capitol attacks days after separately threatening to use the military against what he called the enemy within during a Fox interview. Repeating a call by Vice President Kamala Harris and citing what they call signs of mental and physical decline, more than 200 doctors are calling on Trump to release his medical records. The former president said he would, but so far hasn't. Former Trump aide Sarah Matthews says at 78, he's lost his fastball.
It does appear that he is meandering and rambling more often, and he's having obvious moments of confusion.
Next month, Florida voters will decide if a right to abortion up to viability will be protected by the state constitution. Democrats hope the ballot measure will boost turnout. That includes the former congresswoman narrowly trailing Senator Rick Scott. Debbie Mukarsel Powell says the Republican would push for a national abortion ban.
I don't want my daughters to be living in a state with less rights than I did.
Florida is one of 10 states where abortion rights will be on the ballot. A Georgia judge has ruled that county election officials can't delay certifying election results past a week. The decision came the same day early voting began there. Democratic Senator John Ossoff says Georgians shouldn't wait until election day to vote.
Your car might die. You might have a family emergency. The weather might be bad. Please get out there and vote.
Harris' campaign continues to focus on a key Democratic bloc, Black men, including offering a million fully forgivable $20,000 loans for Black entrepreneurs. In an interview with The Shade Room, Harris says she doesn't take their votes for granted.
Black men are no different from anybody else. They expect that you have to earn their vote.
Groups representing workers, retirees, and small business owners say they'll be left to pick up the slack when the wealthy and big corporations don't pay their fair share in taxes. Linda Somo with the Arizona Alliance for Retired Americans says it would only get worse if the Trump tax cut gets extended next year.
It really ticks me off when I think, okay, I pay 15% and someone who is a billionaire probably is paying a far less percent because they can take advantage of all kinds of loopholes.
Republicans argue extending the tax cut would lead to economic growth. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, households making less than $100,000 a year saw no benefit from it, while top executives did well. An 11th hour agreement between voting rights groups in New Mexico could help make it easier for folks with a criminal record to register for next month's election. Blair Bowie with the Campaign Legal Center says that right had been hard for them to exercise.
The officials who are responsible for implementing that law have really dragged their feet.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacific Network and Public News Service.
Fulton County Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney just blocked a new rule requiring Georgia Election Day ballots to be counted by hand after the voting closes. That ruling came one day after he also ruled that county election officials must certify election results by the deadline set in law. The rulings are deemed to be victories for Democrats. Some legal experts had previously raised concern that Donald Trump's allies could refuse to certify the results if the former president loses to Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris in next month's presidential election. They've also argued that new rules enacted by the Trump-endorsed majority on the state election board could be used to delay certification or to undermine public confidence in the results. Georgia's election board passed a rule last month requiring that three poll workers each count the actual paper ballots by hand after the polls close. The local election board in Cobb County near Atlanta filed a lawsuit seeking to have a judge declare that rule and five others recently passed by the state board invalid. The county board said the state officials exceeded their authority and that the rules weren't adopted in compliance with the law. McBurney blocked its enforcement while he further considers the merits of the case. He ruled earlier this week that no election superintendent or board member can refuse to certify or abstain from certifying election results under any circumstance. McBurney said, quote, "The election season is fraught. Memories of January 6 have not faded away. Anything that adds uncertainty and disorder to the electoral process deserves the public," end quote. The judge said they are entitled to inspect the conduct of an election and to review related documents, but added, quote, "Any delay in receiving such information is not a basis for refusing to certify the election results or abstaining from doing so," end quote. Georgia law says county election superintendents, quote, "shall certify election results by 5 p.m. on the Monday after an election or the Tuesday if Monday is a holiday," end quote. State and national Democratic groups that had joined the suit on the side of the Cobb election board, along with the Harris campaign, celebrated McBurney's ruling in a joint statement, saying, quote, "From the beginning, this rule was an effort to delay election results to sow doubt in the outcome, and our democracy is stronger thanks to the decision to block it," end quote. Republicans in several swing states have already refused to certify results earlier this year, and some have sued to keep from being forced to sign off on election results. Fulton County Board of Elections member Julie Adams refused to certify two primary elections earlier this year and has ties to groups that denied Trump lost the 2020 election. McBurney earlier this month heard a challenge to two certification rules brought by the state and national Democratic parties. Another Fulton County judge is set to hear arguments in two challenges to rules tomorrow, one brought by the Democratic groups and another filed by a group headed by a former Republican lawmaker. Separate challenges are also pending in at least two other counties.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Cheryl Roberts, the executive director of the African American Alliance for Home Ownership. We'll be talking about their 25th annual home ownership fair coming up on October 26th. Then we'll be joined by Laura Grimes from Oregon Arts Watch to learn more about the latest in the local art scene. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is wet and cold with showers dropping to 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather dries up, but the clouds remain, staying around 58 degrees. Today in history, baby Jessica is stuck in a well. In 1987, 18-month-old Jessica McClure is rescued after being trapped for 58 hours in an abandoned water well in Midland, Texas. The quote of the day is from a full moon flick, The Wolfman. Just in time for tomorrow's harvest moon, Maleva warns us, quote, "Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright."
Several Native American tribes have filed a lawsuit against some social media giants, alleging their apps hurt the mental health of young Native Americans. The new film, Res Ball, streaming on Netflix, follows the Chuska Warriors, a high school basketball team from a town in New Mexico on the Navajo Nation. And 48 years ago, as part of America's 1976 bicentennial commemoration, a Senate resolution authorized President Gerald Ford to proclaim October 10th to the 16th as Native American Awareness Week. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Several Native American tribes have filed a lawsuit against some social media giants, alleging their apps hurt the mental health of young Native Americans. CBS News says the case was heard Monday in Minneapolis. The 164-page suit was filed by Minnesota's Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, and two other tribes in the Dakotas. The defendants include Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, and YouTube. The suit claims parent companies to these popular social media sites, including Alphabet, ByteDance, Meta, and Snap, violated Minnesota's laws against public nuisance, negligence, deceptive trade practices, and unfair or unconscionable acts. The allegations further say the social media companies failed to warn users of negative mental health consequences associated with social media use, especially for children and adolescents. It claims the companies knew the more time spent on the platform, the more likely users would see content that is violent, sexual, or encouraged self-harm. Native Americans suffer higher rates of suicide than other demographics in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. CBS affiliate WCCO said an Alphabet representative said the allegations were untrue and that providing young users with a safer and healthier experience has always been at their core. WCCO also reached out to ByteDance, Meta, and Snap, but did not hear back. A new film streaming on Netflix follows the Chuska Warriors, a high school basketball team from a town in New Mexico on the Navajo Nation. Clark Adamitis spoke with a Shiprock-based designer who designed the Chuska Warriors basketball uniforms that are featured prominently in the movie.
The Chuska Warriors ranked number 2 in the preseason poll, and I'm saying this is our year.
Resball follows the high school basketball players as they deal with issues that disproportionately affect indigenous communities, including suicide and alcoholism. Spring Hill Company, LeBron James' film production venture, produced the film, but the film's wardrobe didn't feature Nike-exclusive clothing, despite the basketball legend's lifetime deal with the company. Instead, the players don uniforms designed by Shiprock, New Mexico resident Rodel Denetso.
I'm just this little Rez kid with a shop that I ran out of by my house.
Denetso runs a one-person business, Black Streak Apparel, designing indigenous-themed sports garments for youth teams all over Indian country. Denetso designed Chuska Warriors home and away uniforms, a turquoise championship colorway, shooting shirts, the cheerleaders' uniforms, and other apparel seen throughout the movie.
What if I do pinstripe but with spears? In return, it goes with the team name, which is the Warriors. Then the colors, turquoise, one of our sacred colors.
Denetso got to watch his jerseys in action on set. He felt emotional watching the filming in and around the community.
I think my coming to reality moment was they were unloading stuff to go on set, and they had a cart. And it said Black Streak Apparel. It had like the stuff I had done.
Rodel Denetso says he hopes to inspire young people to show pride in their culture, and he hopes to reach more customers for his custom-made garments because of his work being shown to a large audience via Netflix.
Bring it in. Come on.
1, 2, 3.
Come on. Come on.
I'm Clark Adamitis.
And 48 years ago, as part of America's 1976 bicentennial commemoration, a Senate resolution authorized President Gerald Ford to proclaim October 10th through the 16th as Native American Awareness Week. 14 years later, Congress passed a joint resolution to designate November as the first National American Indian Heritage Month, which President George H.W. Bush signed into law. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
A coalition of anti-hunger groups is pushing for Oregon lawmakers to support free school meals for all students in the 2025 legislative session. 9 other states have adopted such programs known as universal school meals. Eric Tegadoff has more on the story.
It's National School Lunch Week, and groups in Oregon are taking this opportunity to encourage lawmakers to make school meals available to every kid in the state. The School Meals for All Coalition is calling for legislation to make breakfast and lunch free for all Oregon students. The coalition wants lawmakers to adopt the policy during their 2025 session. David Whelan with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says the state is already close to this goal.
About 1,191 schools in the state are already participating, and we're only 65 schools away. We're so close to the finish line in realizing this vision.
9 states have adopted universal school meals. Opponents have pointed to the high cost of providing meals to every student in the state. But 1 in 6 Oregon children faces hunger, according to Feeding America data. Lauren Naldoza with Oregon Food Bank says free school meals have a number of benefits, including helping students academically.
Our Fight for a Universal School Meals program ensures that any student who doesn't have a lunch that day won't have to worry about being hungry because one will be ready for them. And we're going to see this pay off in the short term and in the long term.
Whelan says the policy the School Meals for All Coalition is pushing for would also improve food quality.
Moving to a free breakfast and lunch program gets rid of the administrative overhead, and our proposal is going to slightly increase funding so that more money is going to fresh ingredients that our scratch cooks and children enjoy and deserve.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Some marine biology experts are calling for a ban on fishing in what's known as the deep sea mesopelagic layer, for fear that it might disrupt the food chain and decrease carbon sequestration. Susan Potter has more on the story.
Modern technology is making it feasible to fish for creatures of the deep sea in what's known as the mesopelagic layer, but some marine biologists are calling for a moratorium. The so-called ocean twilight zone, about 660 to 3,300 feet down, is home to 90% of the ocean's total biomass of fish. Dee Jin, a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, says he thinks a total ban is too drastic.
You do have this real demand for aquacultured seafood. As a result, you're either trashing the forage fish, or here is an opportunity. Maybe you can save the forage fish and then supplement with some ocean twilight zone fish. I mean, this is a win-win situation.
The tiny translucent fish caught in the ocean twilight zone are mostly used to feed larger farmed fish or to make fish oil supplements. But fishing in this zone is still rare because it requires lots of fuel and the catch turns to mush if not refrigerated immediately. In 2016, the feds passed limits on capturing some species of mesopelagic fish off the West Coast. Jin says some marine biologists are concerned that fishing in the mesopelagic layer could harm biodiversity.
They fear that you're actually disturbing the food web. You have the top predator, they dive down to feed on the mesopelagic fish. So the recent study suggests certain tuna, two-thirds of their diet actually from the mesopelagic fish.
Some experts have also raised concern about disrupting the process of carbon capture, which occurs when mesopelagic fish surface, feed, and then descend back to the darkness where they excrete the carbon dioxide or are eaten, thus sequestering the carbon deep in the ocean. This story was produced with original reporting by She and Kim for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Portland's Union Station is up for sale at $250 million. Prosper Portland, the city's economic development agency, bought the station in 1987 and has made minor improvements over the last four decades. But the station needs seismic retrofitting, like platform upgrades and track reinforcement, because it hasn't received structural improvements since its last remodel in 1927. Prosper Portland and Amtrak, the most prominent tenant of the station, occupying 40,000 square feet, were in discussion regarding the sale, but Amtrak backed out. Sean Ullman, a Prosper spokesperson, told the Oregonian, quote, "Those conversations have been put on pause due to changes in Amtrak's federal funding, staff capacity, uncertainty about preservation costs, and other organization priorities. Discussions did not evolve to a point where a price was agreed to," end quote. Though Prosper announced the sale last summer, they have not widely advertised the property because they want to ensure their values, not competition, guide the process. Ullman said Prosper is focused on keeping the station with a company that is regionally and transportation focused, like Amtrak, the Oregon Department of Transportation, and other government agencies. The station holds historical, cultural, and logistical significance for Portland as the oldest and longest lasting passenger terminal on the West Coast.
Dan's extended forecast is stormy weather.
Hurricane Milton went from birth to death in a week and a half. Hurricane Trump is 3 weeks away, and there's nowhere to evacuate to. People could do nothing about Milton, but maybe half the people in America plan to let Hurricane Trump happen. This weather shifts all the time. Rain promised 3 days ago often fails to show up. But Donnie's going to storm no matter what the voters say, because his goal isn't winning the election, but taking the White House by lawsuit, Supreme Court, or violent dishonesty. And here in Portland, we'll have 4 or 12 new weather systems with a law and order tornado able to erupt at any minute, not just breaking ties, but breaking spirits. What will increase faster, the number of homeless beds or the number of police officers? It's appropriate that the rains have begun. I hallucinate progressives, creatives, LGBTQ folks, and compassionates going 2 by 2 looking for an arc, and it's only 21 days to the election, not 40. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael. Hurricane Milton went from
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 16th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Susan Potter, Eric Tegethoff, Alex Gonzalez, Mark Morin, Mike Moen, and Brian Bull. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Zachary Jones-Naray.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our wonderful members. If you would like to become a wonderful member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On Saturday, October 26th, the African American Alliance for Homeownership will hold its 25th annual Homeownership Fair in Portland. It's an opportunity to educate people and increase homeownership for African Americans and other underserved people. I spoke with Cheryl Roberts, the executive director of the African American Alliance for Homeownership, to learn more. So, what is the African American Alliance for Homeownership?
Well, gosh, that's a loaded question.